From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan or on demand as a podcast. It's Wednesday, October 18th, 2023. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunavchij, Hawa, Salama, for joining the conversation. On today's show, election results are in. We'll talk with KTOO reporter Katie Anastas about the results and other city topics. On Friday, October 27th, the Evening at Egan Lecture discusses the Suicide Basin outburst flood and the future. We'll get a preview. But first up, this Friday night at the Crystal Saloon, get your laughs on as a Seattle-based improv group, No Script, All Wit, comes to Juno. Those conversations, music, and more coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
Hansen grass, ka eat with the shu yi, we ka shuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta ka na kaya ha ani kak, gunish cheese.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. That's Roselle Nava. As we continue to celebrate Filipino-American History Month, as well as the launch of Maga Cuento, a project from KTOO News. It's a podcast available on your podcast app of choices, with two episodes out now and three more planned over the coming Fridays. Also, an ongoing exhibit at the Juno Douglas City Museum entitled Maga Cuento Filipinos in Juno. For more on the podcast, visit ktoo.org. And for the museum exhibit, visit juno.org/museum. You're listening to Community Supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Ocbay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm Boston Christopher. Improv performances can be a wonderful adventure in playing and fun, like the spur of the moment. And this Friday, players from Unexpected Productions, Seattle's oldest and most successful improvisational theater company, they have their own troupe. They're called No Script, All Wit. They will perform a show at the Crystal Saloon, and here to chat about it via Zoom from Seattle, because they haven't gotten to Juno yet, is Tristan Morris. Hi, Tristan.
How are you doing today, Boston? I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm good. Gunavchij, for joining us today. So first off, for those who haven't experienced it. Will you share what improv is and the kind of experience that folks will be having on Friday night?
Yeah, absolutely. So improv, I mean, at its core, it's just making it up on the fly. So it's live theater, but we will be no script, as the title suggests. We have nothing prepared beforehand as we go in. We might know some basic ideas for structure that we want something to have, right? So we might go in and say like, hey, we're going to do something where as many scenes as possible, as many little short scenes as possible in 5 minutes. And that's all that we know. And then we take everything that we need to build that from the audience itself. So the people who are there to see it give us suggestions and we just run with it from there. So you're going to see a lot of things. It's based on kind of the energy that we're getting from the folks in the audience. And we have such a really great diverse cast of players too. We have people who are really, really good at making emotionally grounded scenes that really leave you feeling like you watched something really deep. And then we have people who are just really good at quick fire jokes. And so depending on what we get from the audience, that's the kind of thing you'll see.
Absolutely. That's kind of cool. And so how do the audience participate? Is it they shout things out, or they writing things down on paper, or what are the different ways, or are there different styles that you'll be doing that night?
Yeah. So what we typically do for this show in particular, with the eight players that we have, we've decided that we're going to make it a lot of short scenes strung together. So at the beginning of each scene, someone will come out and say like, hey, we're going to do this kind of thing next. And we'll ask the audience a question. Sometimes it's, hey, tell us a story from your life. Sometimes like something a really common one would be like, tell us how you got a scar. What's a scar that you have that, you've got a fun story about, and then we'll do a scene based on that. Other times we're just looking for a word, just one word to kick us off, and we'll start running from there. But it's always starting with just that interaction with the audience of, you know, what is at the top of your mind right now, when we ask you this. It's very kind of like loose, free association.
Oh, that's kind of cool. But they're not going to get like, you know, they're not going to get water thrown on them, like in terms of that kind of audience participation, right? No watermelons coming their way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's no splash zone for this show, at least not planned right now. So leave your raincoats at home. You'll be absolutely, well, I don't know. Juno, don't leave your raincoats at home necessarily. I'm not a weatherman.
You can leave them on the chair, I guess. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah. Hold on a second. There are eight of you coming on Friday night to do this?
Yeah, we put together a pretty large group coming in. Actually, it's eight players. We also have a lighting technician coming with us to be there. And they're just as much of an improviser as the rest of us because they're watching scenes for good endings. They're also controlling the lights around us. So if we're in the middle of a particularly emotional scene, Jeff might change the lights to reflect that, or he could change the lights and we need to switch our mood up on that. But yeah, we have eight really experienced players coming up with us.
Wow, that's so cool. Now, I know most of the folks in this ensemble are sort of grounded at the Unexpected Productions down in Seattle. I mentioned that in the intro, that they're the longest and most successful improv theater company in Seattle. How did the eight of you decide to like get together and be like, hey, we want to form our own sort of thing and we want to go up and start touring around and doing this? How did you all start to do that?
It's actually very interesting. Within the group, we have three or four smaller duos of people who all performed together at different levels. So, for example, myself and my friend Rainey in the group, we have our own little bit that we do called Morris and Morris, because our last names are both Morris, and we pretend to be attorneys, but we're just really bad at it because neither of us knows the law. Whereas Isaiah Harris and Obadiah Freeman, they went to high school together. They've been telling jokes together and doing scenes together for an extremely long time. So they're really good at doing really rapid fire jokes and stuff like that. So we'd all kind of performed together in these little groups and we've all done scenes together. But the real glue that brought this all together was Audrey Kohler. She's actually from Juno and she performs with us at the theater and she's an ensemble member there. And she just decided, she was like, hey, I want to do a show in Alaska. and she asked all of us, and everyone was so enthusiastically on board with it. It came together in the span of like a month or two. We were able to get this whole thing just like from her saying, do you want to do this, to us doing the show.
Oh, that's great. So Audrey's coming back to town. Some people out there might know her. That's kind of cool. So Audrey Kohler's in the group, and they'll be coming here on Friday night. It's at the Crystal Saloon. And of course, you can go to crystalsaloon.com for more information. I'm talking to Tristan Morris, who's down in Seattle via Zoom. And I know some people might know of kind of improv from different things. They might have heard of Second City or some of the other groups out there. They definitely, you know, and there's different forms of improv. And you mentioned a couple, like in terms of having sort of short scenes strung together. And there's like, people get into the weeds of it. There's short form and long form and the Herald version and all these different things. What is your favorite to do?
My favorite. So I started, actually, I think I might be one of the youngest performance wise in the group. So I started just over a year and a half ago with Unexpected Productions doing things. And so I've done a lot of really short form, quick games. And I really loved that. But recently I've been doing some long form shows at Unexpected Productions. Like we recently wrapped up a run of a improvised film noir. So we just did, you know, a full hour long film noir made up on the spot. And that was a lot of fun. But what I really, I think probably my favorite format is kind of the mix of the two, right? Where you're doing some shorter things, but they are all building together. And you actually mentioned a Herald, which is a pretty common improv format that is shorter scenes, but all focused around a single concept and a single word. That's the suggestion at the top. I really love building that kind of thing out. But what we're going to be doing, as you mentioned, for Friday's show is going to be that shorter games that are all kind of played together. And we may see some like larger narrative emerge out of that. We may do some callback kind of stuff. I think overall, actually my favorite thing is really just performing with people that I love. It doesn't matter what the format is.
Right. That's a good answer too. Cause I know it's interesting in the longer forms or even in the short forms, like what will happen, right? Like that's the beauty of improv in terms of like, oh, and will a theme emerge? And it may not, and all that kind of stuff. It's kind of cool. You told us a little bit about your background. How did you find improv and when did you start?
I started, like I said, just over a year and a half ago. It was actually in February. Just before that, for Christmas, my sister had gotten me, or had bought me a class with Unexpected Productions. And Obadiah, who is one of the players who's coming with us, was my teacher for that class. I fell into it. I loved it right away. Immediately started performing. And I just have stuck with it ever since then. So I am a latecomer to the game, but found it and have, in probably the last year and a half, you know, accomplished like a couple years worth of like stage time and practice time, just because I threw myself into it. Our other players that we have, though, Audrey has been doing this since high school. She actually, here in Seattle, she was part of what's called the Hogan Cup, which is a competition between high schools for improv, and her team won several years in a row when she was in high school. Like I said, Isaiah and Obadiah, they've been doing this for years and years. Shannon, who is absolutely lovely, I love her to death. She actually is so good at doing emotionally grounded scenes. And every time I'm in a scene with her, I know that I'm going to leave feeling like I just got done with therapy. She does great scenes and she's been doing this for years. Like the group is just collectively a wealth of experience.
That's so great. And it's so great that you had, did you have zero performance experience before you started?
I had done like little community theater stuff when I was a kid living in Ohio.
Okay.
I had done like two or three little plays. And I think I, like the one year that I was in college, I did a play as well. But it functionally, right. Not too much experience, but I have always been a ham.
That's so great. Yeah. It's so funny. You mentioned the high school. I had an improv group in high school and we competed against the adults that were in town. This was back in Anchorage way, 2 years ago. And, it was a wild night and, we were doing the sentences where they write things on paper. Right.
Right.
And my scene partner, she came over and whispered in my ear and she says, "What's a roctologist?" right? And I was like, you're like 17, right? We're like, I don't know. Yeah. Somebody who studies rocks, I guess. I didn't hear her correctly, because what she actually asked me was here's the kicker. So she goes, okay, we're in a cave. So she set the scene in the cave. And the line actually included the word proctologist and not rocktologist. And of course, I think that won us the competition, because the audience just died because we were in a cave and proctology. It was just hilarious. So in your short couple years here, what's the wildest thing that has happened to you in improv?
Oh, the wildest thing that has happened to me in improv so far. Let's see. You know, I think one of the wildest things for me was actually the first scene that I ever did, straight out of the first class that I had taken. I knew a guy named Johnny Jones. We were both Marine Corps veterans. Both are Marine Corps veterans. I should say, it's not like we lost that status in the last year. But we're both Marine Corps veterans. And so we got along very well. We had a very similar sense of humor. And we got on stage to do this game that Obadiah had taught us, where the audience got to call out different numbers of years, and we had to move either forward or backward in time that many years. So we were building this longer story out of this jumping back and forth. And it was just this kind of wildly magical moment where we were, I think we were already supposed to be like 70 years old. And then someone said 100 years in the future, like 100 years forward in the future. So we were both dead. And in heaven, and the scene wound up being that, like, he had died, because of something that I had caused in his life. And he had had to be a good person his entire life. But then, like, after I accidentally killed him, I devoted myself to, like, giving sunscreen to people for free. And like, that was enough to get me into heaven. He was like, there's no justice in this world.
Oh my gosh. Dumb. That's so funny. And I know most people know some comedians that are famous, like Amy Poehler, Will Ferrell. And I think, you know, improv can help you become a better dramatic performer as well as a comedic performer. But I'm curious about, like, for someone who may or may not want to be a performer, would improv, like taking improv class, be useful in their daily life? Would they get some benefit from that?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's like a common kind of meme that goes around these days that is, you know, what is not a cult but feels like a cult? And I fully believe that, like, Improv 100, right? Just a base level class. I think everyone should do that. Because what you're looking at is the ability to walk into a group of strangers, drop all of your drop everything that you're carrying with you, kind of leave it at the door, and surrender to the idea of just whatever is going to happen in the moment. And the way that I like to describe it is, when you're looking at an Improv 100 class, the key goal of it is, do you remember when you were a kid and you would be playing with people and you could say, I have a sword, and everyone just said, yeah, you've got a sword, you have a sword now, of course you have a sword. And it's learning to bring that back into your life. And you'd be kind of amazed at what that does suddenly for professional life, for personal interactions, because you start really listening to people. You start really paying attention to what they're saying. It's a key skill when you're doing this, but you also start kind of processing things in your head differently, so that you start communicating in a way that leaves space for others to respond and add to the conversation. Because that's the only way to build a scene.
That's awesome. And it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. And you can get your laughs on. You can get your laughs on this Friday, October 20th at 9 p.m. Crystal Saloon, 218 Front Street, downtown. Range of ticket pricing starting at $15. You can visit crystalsaloon.com for more. It's no script, all wit. Tristan Morris from Seattle via the Zoom. Thanks so much for joining me today. And break a leg on Friday night.
All right. Thanks so much, Boston, for having us. We look forward to seeing people from Juneau.
Absolutely. Up next, city updates, including the recent election with KTOO reporter Katie Anastas. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon on KTOO. Here's a little savory moment.
Step in to the savory moment. How are your trusty, hardworking cutting boards these days? What about your handmade wooden spoons and that curvy walnut salad bowl you've been filling with fresh garden greens? If they're looking a little peaked, a little dry and dull, it might be time to book them a kitchen counter massage and rustle up some wood conditioner. There are all kinds of wood conditioners out there. Most contain beeswax with additional ingredients like carnauba wax from Brazilian palm trees and mineral oil, the food safe kind. These have a semi-liquid consistency and a soft, honey-like smell. If those ingredients don't strike your fancy, you can also find products made with coconut oil, with more of a butter-like consistency. You can even just use plain coconut oil. Don't use liquid cooking oils, though, like olive oil or vegetable oil. They'll turn rancid. Here's how to condition your wooden tools. First, wash with warm, soapy water, rinse well, and allow to dry completely. Liberally apply the wood conditioner of your choice. Use a soft cloth, or even better, massage in the conditioner with your fingertips. Use enough so that a noticeable sheen accumulates on the surface. Wait 2 to 3 hours or even overnight for the oils to really soak in. Then wipe off the excess conditioner with a soft cloth. What you'll probably notice first about your spoons, boards, and bowls is their beauty. Conditioners not only protect against water damage, mold, and stains, they also bring out the color and grain of the wood and add a luster that makes your kitchen and dinner table sparkle. Find instructions for making your own food-safe beeswax wood conditioner at savorymoment.org. From the studios of KCAW in Sitka, Alaska, I'm Beth Short Rhodes. Whatever is on your dinner table tonight, may you savor the moment.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Time to chat election results and other city topics with KTOO city reporter Katie Anastas. Gonna have to cheese for being here, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Welcome into Studio 2K. All right, but first, I want to mention that episode 2 of Maga Cuento, which means the stories in Tagalog and is all about the Filipino history and life here in Juneau, that is the episode that you worked on, and it is out now. It's called Filipino Workers Seek the American Dream in Juneau. And folks can go to kto.org/magacuento or get it in your podcast app. And Maga Cuento is spelled MGAKUWENTO. So that's awesome. We were able to play like a pretty long preview about the first 9 minutes or so of the podcast on Friday's episode. But folks can go and listen to the whole thing now. So what was like the best part of working on the podcast? Is there a satisfying moment, or is there something about it that was like really cool for you?
Yeah, I think overall, wanting to cover labor as part of this podcast was really important to me. Labor history is something that I have always been really interested in and have done some research in, and getting a chance to explore kind of a specific piece of that part of Juneau life, especially for Filipino people living in Juneau, was really interesting. And I think what I told Tasha, who created the podcast at the time, was that I like labor history and labor reporting because I think it shows that there are people working in industries that I think often go unseen. And if you take the time to talk to people, they have really incredible stories. And I think that in so many of these industries that I ended up focusing on, ferries as one example, but I touched on nursing. And I feel like those are two things that just make Juneau run, like our healthcare system and the ferry system in all of Alaska. And those are both two industries where there are a lot of people coming over from the Philippines and making all that run.
Absolutely. And big shout out to Tasha Elizarde, who's the community engagement producer here at KTO and the executive producer for the Maga Quinto project. And each of the news reporters worked on it, as well as Adeline Baxter, who's our audience engagement editor. And so all those episodes will be, I think there's three more to come out. They'll come out on the Friday coming, Adeline's episodes this Friday, and there's two more. After that, there'll be Yvonne and also Anna's episode, other reporters here at KTO. So that's really cool. I think it's so far, it's been really great to listen to. And the fact that it's centered here in Juneau and about the Filipino population and during Filipino American History Month is just awesome as well. So it's really, really cool stuff. Okay. So what we're here for is the election results. So last evening, a little bit after the workday, so maybe people haven't seen it unless they got up this morning and saw it, you published a story on the results. So we want to hear the rundown. So let's start with the two incumbents that were up for re-election. What happened?
So those two incumbents were Assembly members Alicia Hughes-Gandies and Christine Wall, and they were both re-elected. They both had been pretty far ahead of their opponents from the first batch of results that came out after Election Day, and they maintained their leads. Alicia Hughes-Gandies got about 1,500 more votes than her opponent, who was Joe Geldof, and then Christine Wall got about 2,500 more votes than her opponent, David Morris.
Do you find that incumbents, and because they don't say incumbent on the ballot, like some elections do, so you don't know that that person was necessarily there, but do you find that even in the assembly races that the incumbent sort of has the edge unless they've done something that is, you know, egregious, I guess, but like, you know, is it like, well, steady as she goes kind of thing? Like they're doing a good job and so we want to keep them in there. No reason to rock the boat.
Maybe. And I think that's something we'll touch on later on in this conversation. Yeah, okay. But I think that, yeah, I think that in both of those cases, like, for example, both Alicia and Christine both talked about the importance of addressing the housing shortage in Juneau. And in both of their cases, they could point to things that they'd already done on the assembly as a group, like starting maybe a step towards regulating short-term rentals by establishing that registration program, or expanding the grants for the mother-in-law apartment
right.
grant program. So there are, I think that the two of them at forums and in interviews could both really point to things that had changed and that I think were in people's minds recently and point to those as examples of
we can get these things done. Speaking to their record kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
And I know both of them talked to me about how you just kind of spend your first year or your first whole term on the assembly just kind of learning the ropes. And right. And they were both like, I have a solid understanding of how all of this works. And I can see why that would be helpful.
It's like starting any job, but it's a really important job. And there's a lot of things and you're in the public eye and you don't want to mess up. So I'm sure that kind of thing is. And I just want to also give you props, Katie, your election guide and your election coverage. You interviewed so many candidates this year. And that's what we're going to talk about next is there were two seats available and there were like 10 people that were up for those seats. And so that was a lot more than in any election I can remember since I've lived in Juneau. And so that was a lot of coverage that you did. And I did use your guide. I don't know if I was supposed to, but I did it while I was in the booth because I had some thought. I was like, oh yeah, what about that? I need to double check that they said something X, Y, Z. So great job on that.
Thank you.
But let's talk about that. Cause it was a little, there was some close races there a little bit, right?
Yeah. So, like you said, 10 people ran for two seats, which was a lot of people. And I think overall pretty exciting because it felt like people are really wanting to get involved in city government, which is always nice. So the two people who ended up winning were Paul Kelly. He took first place, and then Ella Adkisson, who took second place in the area-wide race. And a little background, there were two seats open because there was one seat, Maria Gladyshevsky, who's the deputy mayor right now, is terming out. So her seat, someone needed to replace her for a 3-year term. And then Carol Treem, back in June said that she was resigning to take care of a family member. And so the city needed to elect somebody to fill the remaining 2 years of her term. So that's why there are two seats open. But so Paul Kelly will serve the 3-year term, and then Ella Adkisson will serve those 2 more years.
And it was that decided because Paul got the most votes of the 10 folks, and then Ella got the second most. So she got the 2-year term.
Right.
Right. Okay.
And then I guess one thing to note is that as the city's been releasing these periodic updates on vote counts as more have come in the mail, and one thing that we'd all been watching was seeing Nano Brooks ended up coming in third, and the gap between him and Ella Adkisson was kind of closing with each update, but Ella ended up holding up to her lead.
Wow.
And I think it was about 115 votes more than Nano. So still fairly close.
Whoa, that's pretty close. Yeah. Yeah. And I know, I think Ella made a point of this in her speaking, but she's also very young. Mm-hmm. So she's going to be probably the youngest member of the assembly at this point. And it's interesting to see that because the assembly had sort of gone younger with Carol and Alicia and a couple other folks that they had been over the years. Mm-hmm. And that's just interesting to note that I don't know if that's a sign that more people are voting. I know there were more people this year, right? Wasn't there more people this year?
Yes, slightly.
Okay.
I think there was.
Was it 30? It was a couple percentage points higher.
Percentage, looks like about 400 more people voted this year.
400 more people. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was about a percentage point and a half.
Okay.
All right. Which we'll take.
That's improvement, right?
Yeah.
I'm just curious if it's partly younger folks getting out to vote or not. Like, and is that showing in the results that they're reflecting in sort of who they're choosing or not? So let's get the school board. There were only 3 people running there, and there were 2 seats available. Who ended up taking those seats?
So David Noon and Brittany Choney Haywood were the winners. They both had strong leads since that first vote count, and they held on to those through the end.
Yeah,
they both got over 5,000 votes. And Paige Sipanouski, who was the 3rd candidate, got about 3,000.
Okay, great. So, yeah, they won by a pretty good margin there. Absolutely. Okay, we talked about voter turnout, and that is interesting because there was a city bond measure on the ballot. And how close was that? Or what did, and that was, this was about the new city hall. A lot of people know about this. They were looking for a smaller bond than they had asked for last year. But what happened?
Well, despite the bond being lower, for a refresher, last year's was $35 million and this year's was $27 million. Even though it was lower, voters still rejected it again. So for the second time, the city hall bond proposal failed. The margin was bigger, though, of course, it's important to have a little footnote that turnout was slightly up. So take it with a grain of salt, maybe. But a little over 600 more people voted no than yes. And that's compared to about 250 more no's than yeses last year.
Maybe that's what brought people out, was they really wanted to vote on the city hall measure.
Maybe.
Now, you put out a story this morning because you found some interesting things about who was elected on the assembly and then also the ballot measure getting turned down. And what was that you found out?
Basically, the 4 candidates who ended up winning assembly seats had all spoken in favor of the city hall bond proposal. And yet the bond proposal failed. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing to happen all at once. And that kind of goes back to what we'd been saying about the incumbents is, do people feel like, you know, keep going on the course that we're going with the incumbents, and we like their decisions. And I think the city hall ballot measure showed a little bit of a wrinkle in that, which was interesting that those 2 things happened at once.
Yeah, I think in the story you quoted Alicia Hughes Scandes, saying, well, maybe we need to. It's sort of the residents saying, maybe we should be looking at some other things that are a little more important right now. and we can come back to that later, or it's not the time for this now. We need to be looking at other things. And so I guess that is something that they need to pay attention to and listen to and be like, well, this is what the people said. They want us, but they don't want that. So what do we do? Right.
Right.
And I think you had new city manager Katie Kester quoted in there as well. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think another interesting thing that Alicia Huzgandes had said was that it felt like in some cases the vote was kind of a more emotional decision, people maybe voted with their heart a little on the city hall bond proposal because there were people who she said would even tell her, yeah,
right,
you know, this makes sense. I understand why the city's asking for this and I see why a new building is needed, but I'm going to vote no because I feel like trust has been broken.
We already voted on this.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And oh, so you bring it back with less money, but we no means no, basically, is what the voters said.
Right.
In essence. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it was a fantastic election. It was really great to see all of the candidates come out. And it was really nice to see that, like you said, like that folks are interested in being on the assembly, that folks are, you know, care about Juneau and want to work for Juneau in a positive way and being on the assembly because it doesn't pay all that much. But the work is really valuable and it really uplifts our community that people want to serve on there and do good work. So that's really cool. So I want to talk about two other things real quick. Telephone Hill. So you went to a meeting, I think the other night, and we're still figuring out what's going on with that. What's the update on Telephone Hill at this point?
So a little background is that the city became the owner of that property in March. And since then has been starting to think about possibly redeveloping that area. So there are 7 houses and 1 apartment building up there right now. It's some of the oldest still standing houses in Juneau. And the state owned that land previously. At least the state owned that land starting in 1984 on. People were paying rent to the state to stay in those houses. And now they're paying rent to the city because the city owns the land. So now the city officials have been saying, this would be a great spot to add some more housing downtown. It's really hard to find a rental or even something to buy downtown. Mm-hmm. And the city sees this as kind of a pretty prime spot for some new development. So the meeting that I went to on Wednesday was the design company that the city is working with presented for kind of potential design options for what a redevelopment plan could look like. And they had different pieces in each of those. So sometimes it would all be townhomes and kind of single family homes. And then there'd be another option that would have just apartment buildings. And then there was one with a mix of them. I think a big takeaway for people at that meeting was that there was only one that kept the homes standing. So they did have one that had the home standing, but a lot of the attendees had wanted to also feel like an option that left everything as it was also on the table.
I see. Okay. So is there a next step, another meeting coming? Is this something that we were going to be thinking about? And there's no decisions. They were just presenting these plans as options at this point.
Right. And what all of these, they had another meeting back in the summer, kind of a similar community meeting to get people's thoughts on general direction. And this one was a little more concrete, but really nothing has been decided yet. That's going to take the assembly input. And sometime by the end of the year, that design company will have kind of a master plan to say, here's what we think you guys should be working towards based on the community feedback that we got. But in terms of things like what kind of design those individual buildings would have and how many apartments would be in that individual building and what the price will be, those are things that would get determined much further down the road once the city, you know, contracts with a developer and makes those kinds of decisions. So I think there was maybe a sense that everything is happening really fast and all at once, but it's going to take a while before anything really
hurry up and
concrete
wait, right?
happens. Yeah, exactly.
Kind of. All right. And last question. So you had a story a little while ago about where the warming shelter for this winter might be, and you have a quick update on that. Can you share that with us as well?
Yeah. So the plan is for the warming shelter to be at the city's warehouse in Thane, over kind of by the rock dump and that cruise ship terminal over there, with St. Vincent de Paul running it. And so Resurrection Lutheran Church had run the shelter for the last two winters. The short story of it is that their congregation didn't vote in time to apply to rent it again. And so the city came up with this backup plan, and that's what they're moving forward with. So it'll be in Thane, a less central location than the church had been, but they have a transportation plan lined up with St. Vincent de Paul and the Glory Hall and Capital Transit to help get people there and back.
Yeah. And again, the goal is to open this on Friday, right? This Friday?
Yes.
Yeah. As, I mean, it's definitely getting colder out there for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, you can follow more from Katie Anastas and the entire news team at ktoo.org. All these stories that we've talked about, Katie has published recently, and there is more on the horizon. So Katie Anastas, thanks for coming in today and sharing with me all this good information. Gunath Cheech.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Up next, the flooding from Suicide Basin caused damage and uprooted folks from their homes. Why? And what's the future? We'll look ahead at the upcoming Evening at Egan lecture on the topic here next on KTOO. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akwan. The Glen A.D. have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot, once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages, and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life. For today, and for future generations.
Sounds wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
On a sunny and chilly March morning in 2023, a weird animal runs across Grubstake Avenue in Homer. It's a possum, and possums are not native to Alaska. The possum was discovered a few days earlier when workers were unloading a shipping container from Washington State. It escaped and ran around Homer for 2 months before it was finally caught and sent to the Alaska Zoo in Anchorage. Possums are native to the eastern United States and are officially known as Virginia possums. They were the northernmost marsupial in the world, even before they were introduced to the Pacific Northwest, where they spread into southern British Columbia. Well, as it turned out, the possum in Homer was a female, and she was pregnant. She delivered a litter of babies before she was captured in May of 2023. Those babies, called Joeys, just like other marsupial babies, survived just fine after her capture. And in late May, young possums began appearing. By mid-June, 5 young possums had been captured in Homer. Possums are considered an invasive species in Alaska, and potentially they can pass diseases on to native wildlife, and they could prey on native birds, insects, and animals. Biologists hope that this chance introduction does not allow possums to establish a population here. For Sounds Wild, I'm Riley Woodford.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon, live from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston, Christopher. This summer, the flooding from Suicide Basin impacted many homes and people here in Juneau. Why was it larger than in previous years, and how can we better forecast for the future? Well, that's the topic of the next Evening at Egan lecture at the University of Alaska Southeast next Friday, October 27th at 7 p.m. Joining me now to discuss all of this is Karen Selkaitis, Dean of the School of Arts and Sciences, and Dr. Aaron Hood, Professor of Environmental Sciences and Department Chair of the Natural Sciences. I'm having trouble with the word sciences today. I'm going to choose for you both being here today. Hi.
Hey. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Boston.
Of course. Okay. So, and I know that just one other person will mention Aaron Jones. So we've got Aaron and Aaron. Aaron Jones with the National Weather Service.
Jacobs.
Oh, Jacobs. Sorry. Oh, yes. Jacobs. I read it wrong off the page here. Aaron Jacobs from the National Weather Service will be joining you on the talk next Friday as well.
Yes, yeah, that's okay. Right. So our goal is really to give people an understanding of what happened this year, why it was different from what has happened in the past, what we've learned since the flood occurred in terms of what was different and also what that means for the future. And so I'm going to talk about the research that we're doing up in Suicide Basin and the measurements that we make and show people some videos just so they can get a sense of where the flood comes from, right? Because it seems like this mysterious place up in the glacier that's holding all this water.
This badly named place.
This very badly named place. Unfortunately, yeah. We were in the process of trying to change the name, and then all of this happened. It makes it more difficult to change the name because it's more appearing in the newspaper.
Yeah.
At any rate, so I'll be talking about that part, and then Aaron Jacobs from the National Weather Service we'll just be talking about how they do the forecasting, how they push out emergency alerts, what it means for you if you're in the valley in terms of, you know, where you can get information about the flood, and then probably how they are going to change the forecasting in the future based on what we've learned from this year.
Oh, that's so interesting. I know we had you on the show right after it, and we were talking a little bit about different things, but what has happened in the meantime? What is one of the things that maybe you've learned that we didn't know when the flooding happened?
Well, the main thing that we've learned is that we are able to go up to the basin. We can take a helicopter up there, and we actually use drones to make a digital model or map of the basin. And so by doing that after the flood, we can see very clearly some of the ways that the basin itself is starting to evolve over time. And that can help us to think about how it might change in the future. If you imagine this basin, it's bedrock on three sides, and then the fourth side is walled off by the glacier itself. And so it can change and evolve on that fourth side because the ice can melt or calve icebergs. And so it showed a lot of sort of relatively rapid evolution from what we've seen in the past.
Yeah, because I think people understand the concept of like how a river changes, you know, as time goes on, the river changes path and it does different things. And so this is sort of similar to that in a way, right? Or
it is in a way. What's changing here that we're studying is kind of it's essentially a reservoir up there that's holding water, and the main glacier is the dam that holds the water back.
Okay.
But the dam itself is changing, its height is changing, its thickness is changing, the amount of ice that's calving off it is changing. And so that has some important implications for how much water can be held in the basin. And then also, again, allows us to think to the future, like this is these kind of natural hazards occur on the scale of decades. So they appear. This one appeared in 2011. They occur for some number of decades, and then they disappear because eventually the dam, which is the glacier, is going to disappear.
Right.
And at that point, there's no more outburst flood.
I see. Okay. And so, I'm sure that the city as well is trying to figure out, like, you know, from everything that happened this year, what do they need to prepare for next time around? Or is there a way to do, like, maybe Aaron Jacobs will be dealing with this too in terms of forecasting when he talks next week. But if they can get a sense of like, oh, this is preparedness, right? Like
yes.
Seeing something that might be like, oh, it's going to do something similar to last year. And we know that weeks ahead now, so people can be a little bit, I don't think people were as prepared for this year, right? It just sort of surprised us.
Yes. Well, I think it surprised us because we forecasted it to be similar in magnitude to what we've seen in the past. And that turned out obviously not to be the case. It was about 50% larger than any flood we've seen previously on Mendenhall River.
50%?
So, yeah.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah. The largest stream flow ever measured on Mendenhall River was 16,000 cubic feet per second. And it was 26,000 cubic feet per second during that flood. So it was really just like a whole different level. And that's what, you know, the result of that was, if you went out to the bridge, you saw the carnage going of couches and decks and houses and things that fell into the river. So we have a much better handle on potentially what that upper limit could be because of what happened last year.
Yeah.
And then the real challenge is just thinking about how that may change in the future.
I see. And it's great. I mean, people go to these Evening at Egan lectures. They learn about this. You're going to learn about sort of what happened a little bit more, maybe how the predictions will change in the future. And is there something that people can take away from this lecture next week of what they can do? Is there things that a person should be watching out for or paying attention to?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely going to be heightened interest in the forecast for next year.
I think
You know, honestly, there was a bit of a misfire this year because the water level in the basin, which we watch very carefully, started to drop. And so a flood warning was issued. And then we realized it wasn't because the basin was draining. It was because water was flowing over the top of the dam. And so then they took the flood warning away and said, oh, wait, it's not draining. And then 4 or 5 days later, when it did start draining, the flood warning came back up. And so I think for some people, I was like, oh, I think I heard this before. And, you know, it just sort of muddled the message a little. And so I think we really want to, and this is what Aaron will be talking about, is just clarify this and also show people the online resources that we have where you yourself can go online and track what's going on and see. We have a camera in there that transmits images every day. So you can have a window into what's going on up there and monitor it for yourself.
That's great. And it's the Evening at Egan lecture at the University of Alaska Southeast. It's next Friday, October 27th at 7 p.m. It'll be all about the Suicide Basin flooding, what happened, what the future is. And it'll be Dr. Aaron Hood, who's with us today on Juno Afternoon, as well as Aaron Jacobs with the National Weather Service. So turning to you, Karen, this isn't the only Evening at Egan lecture. There's going to be a few more. So what should we be looking forward to as the season continues?
Yeah, we're really excited in Arts and Sciences. So Arts and Sciences kind of took over the Evening at Egan conversations this year. And one thing that we did was we've made it really intentional that UAS wants to welcome the community back in person. We want lots of people on campus this year. So we actually cut down the number of Evening at Egan's a little bit. And one thing that allowed us to do is be responsive when things like this happen. So when Suicide Basin happened and we this natural disaster, that we said we want to be responsive. We want to be able to make space for a community conversation. So when we have sort of we've made space for these four conversations each fall, it does allow us to be responsive to things that come up in the community, and we have space in there to be able to add some. And so in this case, we added one. But we do have one coming up after this. We have Jim Powell, who is going to be talking about cruise ships and communities. So Arts and Sciences has four distinct areas. And we tried to, when we were creating our Evening at Egan series, have all of them represented. Mm. So our first one had to do with herring. This one, obviously, is also science related. Our last conversation was more social science and had to do with brain health. Our next one has to do with business and tourism and our communities. And then our last one, we're calling our Winter Fire Showcase. So that cruise ship conversation is happening on Friday, November 10th with Jim Powell. And then our final one is called our Winter Fire Showcase. That's Friday, December 8th. And that's Ernestine Hayes, Lily Hope, myself, and Emily Wall. And we're all doing something. Each of us are doing a unique artistic piece together.
I think that's great. I think you guys did that last year too, right?
We did something very similar.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's a great way to go into December and, you know, sort of get warm for the season and have a little arts in your life.
That's exactly how we're looking at it.
Yeah. And you can find out more, of course, at uas.edu. And the evening Egan lectures are there. And the other thing that's really cool is that if you can't make it, they are live streamed and they are also archived on the YouTube channel. And you can just YouTube it and search for Evening at Egan and it will come up and you can watch all of them in case you can't make it. But it is really lovely to be in person.
It is. Like, and we have snacks. We've got some cookies and fruit. We've got snacks. So the good snacks are good. There's always a Q&A session after, so the speaker will talk for a while. And then after the speaker's finished, there's always some engagement with the audience. And so a little, you know, speaker engagement plus good snacks is always a reason to come out to campus.
And for those of us who live downtown or in Douglas or even in Lemon Creek, it's a great excuse to get out the road a little ways and go out to UAS and see what's going on out there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. And then there was one other thing. You had an announcement to make.
We do. Aaron, I'm going to let you talk about this.
Yeah. So this has been a long time coming, but we are nearing completion of our new science building at UAS, which is going to be focused on environmental sciences. And so this is a plug to all the young people out there who want to come to UAS and study environmental science and things like outburst floods and glacier change. And so the building will be completed hopefully in February.
February, March, probably.
Yeah, and then open for business over the summer and then available to students starting next fall. That'll be really great that we'll have labs in the buildings where we teach, where we have our offices. And so it will be a really integrated facility that should, really boost hopefully the profile and also the success of our environmental science or what we refer to as the program on the environment at UAS, which is everything from environmental studies to environmental resources and then environmental science.
And who doesn't want to study environmental science in Alaska?
I mean, it's the best place for it. Well, that sounds awesome. Again, you can hear Dr. Aaron Hood along with Aaron Jacobs from the National Weather Service next Friday, October 27th at 7 p.m. It's the Evening at Egan Lecture. They'll be talking all about Suicide Basin and the flood this summer and how we can predict it and also work towards better things in the future.
I also feel like I have to give a plug to the name of the new building because our Board of Regents just approved a Tlingit name.
Oh, nice.
And so the name of that building is Oktahit, and we're really excited about that.
That's so good. I love it. Oktahit.
Oktahit, house at the head of the Little Lake.
House at the head of the Little Lake. I'm sure Dr. Twitchell had some help.
Oh, yes, he did.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Karen Salkaitis and Dr. Aaron Hood from UAS, thanks for joining me today.
It was so great to see you.
Thank you.
Sheesh. Awesome. That will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Have a wonderful Wednesday. On tomorrow's show, culture-rich conversations, domestic violence prevention through education. Host Christina Michelle and her guests will discuss the importance of teaching prevention in an effort to end domestic violence in America. Juno Afternoon airs Tuesday through Friday at 3 p.m. here on KTO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Ok Bay 91.7. Hello out the road and UAS and all that good stuff. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, give us feedback, suggest ideas, or find out how to be a guest on the show. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Lisa Purvis.